start, I just want to let Art know I have to leave at least for a few minutes, moments before 10 a.m. for a court hearing. If we're not done, I'll come back, or Jorge will wrap up the meeting in my absence. So, okay, let's get started. Good morning, everybody. This is the March meeting of the Tucson Supplemental Retirement System Board of Trustees. Art, would you call the roll, please?
Sure, Mark.
Here.
I don't see Kevin at roll call. Jim.
Here.
Jorge.
Here.
Elsa.
Here.
Aaron.
Here.
And I believe that's it. We have a quorum.
Okay, great. First item on the agenda is the consent agenda. Do I hear a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved, Mrs. Jorge.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second, Jim.
Thank you. Any discussion? All right. Art, would you call the vote, please?
Sure. Mark?
Aye.
Kevin? You're on mute, but I caught that as an aye. Jim?
Aye.
Jorge?
Aye.
Elsa?
Aye.
Aaron?
Aye.
Motion passes, what is that, 6-0?
I believe so. Thank you.
Anastasia, note that roll call Jeff Whiting is absent and Kevin joined at 8:31.
Can do.
All right. The first item on our administrative discussion is the actuarial experience study review. Welcome, Dana. And Art, do you want to introduce the subject or just turn things over to Dana? Whatever you
sure,
want.
Sure, I can introduce it real quickly. As a reminder, the board directed staff and GRS back at our September meeting to convene a five-year experience study, which Dana has and her team have done. I believe there will be some requests to change some of the assumptions that we have been working under for the proceeding next 5 years. But I'm probably stealing Dana's thunder here a little bit. So that's the purpose of the agenda item. And I will turn it over to Dana to walk through the presentation and the materials that were sent out earlier this week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Art. I think Paul is going to share the presentation. There we go. Awesome. Thanks, Paul. All right. Well, thanks for having us here today to talk about your actuarial experience study results. Most often when we're here to talk about your annual actuarial evaluation. An experience study takes sort of a longer term view of things. We reassess how things have been trending over several years, and we look at how your assumptions have stood up against that experience, and we basically adjust our expectations. For the most part, what we found is that your assumptions are holding up pretty well. And as far as experience studies go, hopefully these results are pretty painless. All right. I'm still seeing slide one. Are you guys still seeing? There we go. Awesome. Okay, so we'll spend a few slides getting oriented on the experience study, talk about why we do this. We'll go through your demographic assumptions, your economic assumptions, and then we'll take a look at what your 2023 valuation would have looked like under the assumptions that we're proposing to move to. All right, so why do we do experience studies? The analogy that I usually use on this has become a bit awkward over the last couple of days. It involves steering large ships, but suffice it to say, pension plans do not turn quickly, and we need to constantly adjust course. And so we, as the actuary, we look at your plan experience, and we try to determine if it's trying to tell us something. You know, if we're consistently off one direction or another, then we need to change our assumptions going forward. And so we bring those changes to you for your approval. And generally, we do this every 3 to 5 years. It has been 5 years since the last study, and so we were due for a look. All right, so depending on how long you've been on the board, you might have a negative connotation with experience studies. Public sector plans have had some pretty big band-aids to rip off over the last decade in terms of bringing discount rates down, in terms of introducing generational mortality into our models, and that caused some pretty big changes in the funding outlook for a lot of plans, yours included. And so I just want to tell you up front, that's not what you're going to see today. We're recommending some pretty modest assumption changes for the most part. And when we get to the impact section, you'll see that the change to the numbers that we report every year is going to be pretty minimal. So in terms of the funding expectations, in terms of how long it's going to take to fully fund this plan, it's almost no change at all. All right, so we're going to spend just a couple slides talking about how these valuation assumptions get used. On the liability side, plain and simple, assumptions are used to project benefits paid from the plan. So you have an active member. What will their career path be? Will they quit mid-career? Will they make it to retirement? If they make it until retirement, will they stay past first eligibility? And once they get to those points, what will their benefit be? What will their salary do over their career? And then once they're in payment status, how long will that benefit continue to be paid? On the asset side of things, what will the trust earn? We know that we rely heavily on investment earnings to pay for a large portion of the benefits, so that investment return assumption is going to be a very important assumption. And then lastly, how will the payroll grow? Basically, how much will that 27.5% of pay we get from the city, how much will that mean for this plan and the money coming in? Okay, so slide 5 was about how the model works. Slide 6 is about how real life works. We can make all sorts of assumptions, but ultimately none of them determine the true cost of the plan. What assumptions help us do is manage expectations and manage the timing of contributions. The true cost of the plan is based on actual participant behavior when people actually retire, when they actually die, actual investment returns, and the plan provisions that are in place. So we want to have reasonable expectations that hold true over the long run for these assumptions. All right, so the main part of the experience study is to look at your actual plan experience. When are people retiring? How many people are quitting before they get to retirement? And how does that compare to what we're currently assuming? Does it need adjustment? On the economic side, past experience, it's not a good predictor of future experience, so it's a much more forward-looking exercise. There, we're going to use some forecasts to develop our expectations. All right, so we have a set of actuarial standards that govern our work, and in particular, those apply to apply to the setting of assumptions and methods for pension plans. All right, so throughout the report, you will see a lot of reference to actual to expected ratios. An actual to expected ratio is basically a measure of how on target our assumption is. So, for instance, of the members that are age 55 and qualify for unreduced retirement, how many of them actually retired? And then we compare that to what our assumptions would have predicted. And so we compare those actual counts of retirements to expected counts based on the assumption, and if it's 100%, then we're right on target. So on your mortality table, long story short, we basically just needed to put you on the most recent published tables. Auditors like to see that you're on the most recent table. Since the last experience study, a new table came out that is based off of specifically public sector data, and so we propose using that new table and then just making a little bit of adjustment to the female table to make it line up better with Tucson experience that we were seeing. Ultimately, this change, combined with the one I'm about to show you on the next slide, it was very little impact to your results. This is more about appearances and conveying that we're paying attention, we're on top of things. We have the most recent assumptions. So almost all plans, including yours, now use generational mortality. And what that means is that we assume a certain life expectancy for a retiree who's 65 today. But then a retiree who's 65 in 5 years from now, we assume their life expectancy is going to be a little bit longer, and so on and so forth. This constant gradual improvement in life expectancy over time. It's built into the model. And so we have to have an assumption for the rate of mortality improvement, of longevity improvement. And so we use standard published tables for that as well. And for a long time, those rates that we were using did not change. Finally, they made a change in 2020, and so we recommend updating to the most recent table. And again, combined with the changes to the base table, there was very little change to the results. It's more about perception, the name of the table that we're using, more than an actual change to your results. All right, retirement and termination can be or are both very important demographic assumptions. They can be big ticket items in experience studies, but your assumptions are still serving you very well based on your experience. And so we made some tweaks here and there to make it fit a little better, but ultimately very little difference to your results. Tier one has some provisions that allow them to cash in their sick and vacation leave at retirement to be able to get some additional credited service towards their benefits. And then they're also able to use that time at their latest rate of pay. So when they retire, they end up with a little bit of a bump in service and final average compensation. We have assumptions built into the valuation so that we're not constantly taking losses on that as it happens. And we found that members during their careers were retaining a bit more leave than they have been. And so we bumped that assumption up a little bit. Again, a very modest change to the results. All right, so actuarial standard of practice number 27 is the standard of practice that governs setting economic assumptions, which we are about to transition into here. And so the first thing it says is that it should be appropriate for the purpose of the measurement. And in our case, that means for purposes of performing the valuation, and in turn, appropriate for determining long-term contribution sufficiency, which is the main purpose of our valuation. In our assumption setting, we should reflect relevant historical and current economic data. That being said, for something like investment return, historical data is not considered particularly relevant. This is going to be a forward-looking assumption. What the fund has earned in the past is not necessarily a good indicator of future experience. So for those purposes, that focus is really going to be on the current economic data and forecasts. And then any assumption we set, we should not set it knowing that it is a bias, has a bias one way or another, unless we want to make it conservative, and then we should specifically disclose that we're doing so. Slide 15 basically just says each assumption has to stand on its own. We can't let two wrongs make a right. So our first economic assumption is always inflation. And it's always first because we use it to build our other economic assumptions. It's the base for salary, for investment return. And right now, your price inflation assumption is 2.5%. And so what we need to do is determine whether 2.5% is still appropriate going forward. Emphasis on the going forward part. So, you know, I know it feels like maybe it should be higher because it has been higher these past couple years. But the thing is, we've already seen those impacts. It is already in the valuation in the form of higher salaries that you've granted. We don't need to assume those anymore. Those are actuals. Those are built in. So instead, how will things evolve going forward? All right. And so what does the evidence say about things going forward? There's no single right answer on these kinds of things. Two experts, two sources can say different things. If we look at the shorter term forecasts, we tend to get some higher expectations, right around your 2.5% assumption. If we look at the longer term forecasts, we maybe see some things that are a little bit lower, some 2.3s, some 2.4s. I absolutely do not see anything here that makes me want to change your current assumption. I think it's still right in the mix, and I think the benefits of stability in this assumption far outweigh any argument for change. All right, so our main consideration in setting TSRS's investment return is going to be your asset mix, your asset allocation. We're going to use that along with what the investment experts think those particular asset classes are going to do over the next 20 years. I have a couple items grayed out here. We do look at historical performance. We do look at peer information. But this is very much secondary to the forward-looking plan-specific information that we get from the asset allocation and the capital market assumptions. On these economic assumptions, there is no one right assumption. So when we go to look at the outcome of modeling, I want you to view it through the lens of what does this information tell us about our current 6.75% investment return assumption and its reasonability. The reason for that is, one, just the appeal of the stability of the assumptions and the consistency of our messaging that we're putting out there. And the second is the recent volatility of the capital market assumptions coming from the investment consultants. I'm trying to set an investment return assumption that will discount cash flows for the next 60 years. And it's hard to do long-term decision-making if we change this assumption every time the wind changes direction. All right, so I mentioned we would look at peer comparisons. Really, all we're looking for here is to make sure we're not extreme outliers. What we're looking at here is a survey from the National Association of State Retirement Administrators. So, maybe not a direct peer, but certainly still informational. Based on the most recent survey information, 7% is sort of the mean, median, and mode for most state plans. But most of these state plans have significant private equity allocations. So I look at your, a Tucson 6.75%, and I think that seems right about in line. There's no conflict from this information. So GRS is not an investment consultant. We are a company of 100 and some public sector actuaries. Our company parties, they're a blast. So what we do is we go out and take a survey of reputable investment consultants, Callan included, on what they think returns will be over the next 10 and 20 years. We borrow their capital market assumptions, and we give you an average of investment return expectations based on your asset allocation and what these different investment consultants are saying those asset classes will return. All right, so how do things shake out? Across the most recent GRS survey, most recent GRS survey is based on 2023 capital market assumptions, and the average geometric return for Tucson for TSRS is 6.89%. Callan recently presented to kick off your ALM study, and they showed a 6.9% expectation based on their 2023 assumptions and a 7.3% expectation based on their most recent 2024 expectations, so right in line there. And does that make me, want to run out and increase your investment return assumption? It does not. Because if we had done this same exercise a year ago, this same model would have produced 5.26% for Tucson. 2 years ago, it would have produced 5.5%. And so going back to that actuarial standard of practice and thinking about the purpose of the measurement, GRS and Callan are trying to do very different things with these capital market expectations. Callan is trying to set your allocation for the next few years, find you the greatest risk-reward combination. GRS is trying to set assumptions to discount cash flows for the next 60 years and help you make decisions regarding contribution sufficiency. And so, you know, I can't move the investment return assumption every time the market bends a different way and these capital market assumptions change. I need more sort of sustained evidence that we need to make a change. And so I think right now you're very well positioned on these economic assumptions. I think you should leave them as is, given another cycle, see if the wind keeps blowing in one direction or the other, and see if we get any more compelling evidence. But for now, our recommendation is to just leave the 6.75% and enjoy the stability of those assumptions. All right, so the last piece then is salary assumptions. And I would say this is the section where the biggest findings were. There are two different types of assumptions that relate to salary. And the first is those that apply to individuals in the valuation, your active members, to project their pay for calculating projected benefits. And for TSRS, right now, that assumption is made up of 2.5% price inflation and an additional 0.5% on top of that, which is meant to reflect that general wage inflation outpaces price inflation. So everyone gets at least 3% in this salary increase assumption. And then there are some age and service-based add-ons. And I'm going to have Paul pop up the salary increase assumption if possible, just so you can see what that looks like. So if you look in these boxes here, if a member is in their first 5 years of service with the city, then we're looking at that first box. Rates tend to be a little bit higher immediately following their hire date, starting at 6% and grading down to 5%. And then once they've completed 5 years of service, it kicks over these age-based rates, which ultimately grade down to that 3%, the 2.5% price inflation, and the 0.5% wage inflation. All right, I'm going to go back over to the PowerPoint 24. Okay, so we looked at 10 years of experience on this. Salary is one of those things where you do have a lot of ups and downs, and trying to figure out what things are going to be for the next 30 years is difficult to gauge based on short-term plan experience. So you do want to have a lot of experience to base this off of to try and even out the hiccups. But that said, even with 10 years of data to average things out, we still think that this data might not be fully representative of the long term. We've got COVID in this time frame, the tightening of the labor market, and Tucson was just coming off of a very extended pay freeze. And so while this data is going to be informative, we're still not going to just take the results and say, set the assumption to that. We're going to moderate our response. All right, so the first thing that we want to look at is the base increase. Right now, we know we have 0.5% on top of price inflation. The way that we get at that number is to look at Tucson's actual experience for members that have at least 20 years of experience. So continuing actives that have at least 20 years of experience, we expect that to be fairly representative of this ultimate increase. And so when we look at how much those pay increases were for those members in excess of price inflation, those members received pay increases that were about 1.5% above actual price inflation. And so again, knowing what we know about this data set, about all the things going on, we recommend going halfway between that current 0.5% and the observed 1.5%, and increasing that base increase up to 1%. So 2.5% plus 1% is the base increase. Everybody gets at least a 3.5% increase. We can get a bit of added confidence on that, knowing that it fits with sort of the national long-term historical data. If we look at the national average wage index over the last 50 years, historically, it has grown about 1% in excess of price inflation. So, you know, before with the 0.5%, you were a bit out of line with that. And moving to the 1%, you're more sort of right in the mix of things with those national averages. All right, so we have our base assumption, and then what we do is we take a look at those age and service-based add-ons, and we did find that those needed to be a bit higher as well. So if we look at the top of the red bar, that was the actual total salary increase for continuing actives, so the different age groups there. The green line is your current assumption. For the proposed assumption, again, we shifted the entire thing up by 0.5% from that base increase, and then we made a few tweaks besides that to the age and service-based amounts. So that's why the purple line doesn't perfectly follow the shape of the green line, is those tweaks that we made on those age and service-based amounts. But again, we did moderate our responses. We definitely did not go the full way on those add-ons. We only went part of the way, so that's why that purple line is still well shy of the actual increases that we observed. All right, so the last few slides were on individual salary increases that we use in predicting benefits. There is a related but separate assumption about how total payroll will grow. So total payroll growth gets used when we calculate your amortization payment and when we set up your funding projections. The higher the payroll growth assumption, the more backloaded the amortization payments and the higher reliance on the payroll, say 10 years from now, to deal with the unfunded liability. So given that you are only 10 or 11 years out from full funding, this isn't as important of an assumption as it is for some plans that are looking 20 or 30 years out to be fully funded. But I still think it would be prudent not to raise your current assumption of 3%. So typically, sort of this building block approach would say, okay, well, if you raise your base salary increase for your individuals to 3.5%, then you would in turn raise this assumption to 3.5%. But you absolutely do not have to do that. We suggest leaving it at the current 3%. If your payroll does outgrow this assumption and you're getting, you know, those 27.5% pay contributions on more pay, that is an easy problem to deal with. It basically means you get to full funding faster than you thought. So we suggest just leaving it at a 3% and not creating any new pressures on this plan. All right, so finally results. Let's talk through what each of these sets of results is first. So on the far left, you have the valuation results that you saw back in October. So all of the assumptions before we make any recommended changes. And then moving to the second column is changing all of the demographic assumptions to those that we are proposing, but nothing else. So just demographic assumptions. The third column takes it a step further, changes the salary assumptions, but also changes the payroll growth assumption with it. So sort of that building block approach I was talking about. If we change the base salary assumption to 3.5%, we would change the payroll growth to 3.5%. And then like we talked about, we don't want to do that. We want to stick with the 3% payroll growth. And so the fourth column is sort of our final results, the full package of recommendations, including that 3% payroll growth assumption. All right, so looking at items 1 through 4, those all, looking at items 1 through 4, so those relate to your liabilities, your accrued liability, your unfunded liability, your funded ratio. Almost no change there. So demographic assumptions were slightly favorable. The liabilities went down. We made the changes to the salary increase assumption that sort of pushed us right back where we were. In terms of item 5 through 8, there was some push and pull on the normal cost and the amortization. But if you look at the total actuarially determined contribution in item 8, if you look at the first column, which is our VAL results, and if you look at the third column before the payroll growth assumption change that we're recommending, or lack of change, the 25.96 and the 26.16, those are very similar results. And so the increase in item 8 was largely from changing salary increase assumptions, but holding back on changing the payroll growth assumption. Looking at item 8, I do want to be very clear that that is both employer and employee in terms of that actuarially determined contribution. So we're nowhere near breaching that 27.5% minimum. We know the employee rate is at least 5%. And so once we net out that 5% or more, we've still got a significant amount of margin between the employer's actuarially determined contribution and that 27.5%. So the reason that we didn't show the employee rate, the blended employee rate, and net that amount out is because the employee rate is very unclear at this point. Given that the city has held the variable rates for several years now, and we've had some changes in normal cost, and now potentially having even more change in normal cost, we're hesitant to just say, okay, the normal cost increase, divide by two, this is what the employer's rate is. So but what we don't want to do is we don't want to not adopt these assumption changes because they increase the normal cost and in turn increase this board recommended employee contribution rate. We think that if it's important to the city to keep those rates low, they can continue to do what they have been doing and not adopt the board recommended rates. I also think that in the next couple of years, we probably will be looking at the funding policy and looking at whether we want to start to glide past that minimum contribution. And when we do that, we can evaluate whether this one-half normal cost is still important to us or whether our priorities have changed. I do think we should adopt sort of the best assumption set and not try to artificially suppress that normal cost. I think it's okay that our normal cost is a little bit higher than those actual employee rates. And so then in item 9, what we did is we said if we use these different assumption sets and we assume that the city will continue to keep the member rates flat and put in their 27.5%, what is our full funding year? You can see it changed very little. So 2034 as the valuation. And then 2035 with all of the proposed assumption changes. And then items 10 is recognizing that those normal costs did increase with those salary changes. And so you can see that the recommended contributions for employees for the tier one variable, once we apply the roundup to that 7.64%, would be 7.75%. Right now, they're only, charging the employees 6.75%, so it get up to a full 1% disparity there. The 5.97 would round up to the 6. They're charging them 5.25, so, 75 basis points of disparity there. But again, strongly recommend that you adopt the best assumptions and consider some policy changes down the road if you're uncomfortable with that disparity on the employee contributions. All right.
Dana, Mark, this is Art. Let me just chime in here while we're on this slide. What I can tell the board that is as of today, what I know today, March 28, 2024 at 9:04 a.m., is that the city manager in his manager's recommended budget is going to recommend that mayor and council adopt the 50 basis point increase to the employee rates for FY25. So he is going to take the board's recommendation and that will be, and I believe they've already had a study session on the subject and mayor and council has tacitly approved that along with our health insurance rates for 25. So I feel pretty comfortable saying that those rates are going to increase for 25 as the actuary's recommendation and then the board's recommendation to mayor and council. So I'm not sure how that will play into the board's decision to adopt the recommendation from GRS, but I can tell you that the manager has and will recommend that those rates be increased for 25.
Thank you. Dana, are you done with your report?
No, a couple more slides here. Okay. Hang with me.
Okay.
All right. So it has been a while since we updated the assumptions that you use in your actuarial equivalents that you use for plan administration. So things like joint survivor factors, cost to purchase service. We did hold off on changing when we changed to the 6.75% discount rate, simply because we knew this experience study was coming soon, and so we didn't want to change and then change again a year later. But now that we do have this new assumption set and we expect it to be stable for a while, we do recommend going ahead and updating to reflect the new assumption set in your plan administration. There's a couple assumptions here that are specific to benefit administration. We aren't allowed to use gender-specific mortality in benefit administration. You can't charge males and females differently. So we do use unisex blend there. And then for practicality, there are a couple of assumptions that we make on mortality and that longevity improvement projection. Some simplifying assumptions to keep those administrative factors tractable. So we will be asking the board to approve both the experience study assumptions for valuation purposes, and then we will be asking the board to approve the specific assumptions on this page for your administrative purposes. All right, so we recommend adopting these assumptions for use in your valuation and your plan administration. We do think these assumptions will provide a better fit going forward. Minimize your gains and losses, and be the best for decision-making. And we would need board action on both items in order to implement these assumptions for those purposes.
I think your slide says slide 28. I think it's actually slide 29.
Oh, you might be right.
Oh, stop.
All right, very good. Yes, slide 29.
Okay, all right. Okay, what I'd like to, well, does anybody have any specific questions before we entertain motions?
Mr. Chairman, this is our, the only thing I would ask for our record keeping purpose is that we specifically and expressly set out what assumption sets we are, adopting. I would prefer not to refer to a slide in this particular instance because there's a lot of assumption sets that Dana just went over, and I want to be very explicit in the minutes and the legal action report with respect to what exactly the board is adopting, especially if it's going to have an impact on the employee contribution rates and the employer contribution rate, because I eventually will have to speak to that.
Okay. I appreciate that concern. My concern is that if we try to state a motion orally without referencing, we may be either incomplete or in error. So
We can get through it. I think what we need to do is confirm or adopt, and Dana, correct me if I'm wrong, we need to confirm or adopt the discount rate assumption, the salary increase assumption, and the mortality table assumption.
Well, I mean, I think I would recommend referencing the entire written report. So, you know, we went through these slides. But usually you would say, you know, the board chooses to adopt the assumptions as laid out in the report dated, I don't know what the date is, or the experience study report for The period ending June 30, 2023, just referencing the main report and all the assumptions that are laid out in there. Because, you know, that report has the full assumption table. It has everything in it. And I don't think we would want to go through and adopt them one by one. The only exception to that would be if there was something I propose that the board did not want to adopt. But as long as the board is just adopting a full assumption set, I think I would just reference the experience study report for the period ending June
30, 2023. Let me make a suggestion that maybe bridges Dana and Art. Perhaps we could entertain a motion to adopt and approve the experience study report, and separately a motion to adopt and approve the actuarial equivalence statements on slide 29, subject to a final approval at the next board meeting by written motion. And that way, Art, you have the opportunity to sit down and draft what you think is appropriate and specific without trying to do that orally. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I'll just make this easier. Just adopt the experience study report, and I'll have to decipher what exactly that means. That's okay.
Are you sure?
Yep.
Okay. I don't mean to make it difficult for you, but I always worry about things getting stated orally and then they're not exactly as planned. All right. Do we hear a motion to approve the experience study report dated? Dana, what's the date?
Oh, I should know that.
March 13th.
I'm sorry, March.
March 13th.
March 16th. Okay, 2024. Do I hear a motion to adopt and approve the experience study report dated March
16, 2024? So moved. This is Kevin.
Second, Jim.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Art, would you call the vote, please?
Sure. Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Jim.
Aye.
Jorge.
Aye.
Elsa.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
Motion passes 6-0.
Okay. Do I hear a motion to adopt and approve the actuarial equivalence assumptions set forth? Are they assumptions?
Yes.
Assumptions set forth on slide 29 of the March 16, 2024 report.
So moved. This is Kevin.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I'll second, Jim.
Okay. Any discussion? Mark, would you call the vote, please?
Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Jim.
Aye.
Jorge.
Aye.
Elsa.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
Motion passes 6-0.
Dana, can you go back to a slide or two earlier, the one that had the four columns? Here we go. Are we, in fact, adopting the fourth column?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Art, would it be helpful to have specific approval of the recommended column?
I think you should be adopting the report. The report basically lays out everything that's in the recommended column. So.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to note that for the second motion to change the actuarial equivalent assumptions, that has to be reduced to a one-page addendum to the city code that I will get ready and send to Art for your signature. So we're required to document as part of the plan documentation those actuarial equivalent assumptions. Okay.
Is the approval of the last motion adequate to support attaching this to the city code?
Yes, it is.
We don't need another motion.
Correct.
Okay, very good. Thank you. All right. Thank you so much for your hard work and clarity. This is not simple stuff, and we very much appreciate it. Paul and Dana, you are much appreciated and welcome to take off if you'd like to.
Sure. If I could just make one quick last comment. Sure. So, you know, we've been sort of breaching the idea of glide pathing these contributions for a while. I think this experience study was a big milestone in that. You've sort of, you know, you've survived another experience study without really pushing out that full funding date very far. And so I do think in the next year or two, we will definitely want to talk about potentially glide pathing the contributions. And second, going hand in hand with that is, does this plan try to fund for a COLA? And so I want you to just sort of start mulling those ideas now, and we'll start talking about those over the next year or two. So.
Okay.
Yeah, and to that point, Dana, if the board is going to want to look at funding some sort of 13th chakra COLA, we will need to start work on that like tomorrow, because that will be getting that policy straightened out and figured out will be an endeavor in and of itself. As we've seen for those board members who've been here a long time, the last time we tried to do it, we spent considerable amount of time, and at the end of the day, just decided to table it until we were closer to, getting to at least 80% funded, which is, you know, when I think we should start to have that conversation. But if the board's going to want to entertain that in the future, we should start working on that 13th chakra PRBI policy.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you all for your time.
Thanks,
thank
Dana.
You.
Thanks, Paul.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay. The next item is the Callan Asset Liability Contract Approval. My sense is Callan is not here today, right?
Correct.
Okay. Good. So. Bye.
Mr. Chairman, this is the contract that I mentioned before. It's a standalone contract with Callan to conduct the asset liability study that the board granted authority to do both last month, and then I believe it was at our October meeting or December meeting as well. It's a $65,000 contract. They will perform the asset liability study as discussed, and we'll bring back the results of that study later this year. I do know that Cassie has a couple of edits, so I believe it is in the indemnification portion of the contract. What we can do, if you guys are okay, generally speaking, is approving the contract subject to the approval, approving the contract subject to the changes that Cassie wants included in the document. I do not think these will be game changers from Callan's perspective. We've made these changes in prior contracts, and they've agreed to the changes. I'm not exactly sure why it did not get included. Those same indemnification language did not get included in this contract. But that's just one proposal. If you'd like to have conversation on it and direct me to bring back the full contract for approval next month, I'm happy to do that as well.
Jim?
Yeah, can we get a summary of the differences of position on the indemnity issue?
Yeah, sure, Jim. When we negotiated the last version of Callan's investment consulting agreement, which I think was early 23, we changed paragraphs 8 and 9. Paragraph 8 is the applicable law, and we used the city's standard provisions to have any disputes resolved in Arizona, specifically in Superior Court in Tucson. And then paragraph 9 on indemnification, the standard language that Callan proposes is indemnification in favor of Callan. We reworked that to eliminate TSRS's obligations to indemnify Callan at all, and negotiated some indemnification in favor of the city by Callan. So we reversed that provision in essence. And I think that was probably an oversight on Callan's part, that they didn't pick up those customized provisions in this standalone agreement.
Okay, thank you.
As a practical matter, the likelihood that there are claims for which indemnification will apply is pretty slim, am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. not a big ticket item, and I certainly understand how a company like Cowan prefers to have all of their litigation where they're located, and our desire is otherwise. So, all right. Any other discussion? Does anybody have major heartburn with approving the contract subject to addressing whatever legal issues Cassie still has?
Yeah. This is Kevin. I don't have any concerns about the contract. I just have a question, Art. So the contract amount is $65,000. Do you recall by chance what we paid the last time we did this, which was probably about 4 or 5 years ago? If you don't, that's no big deal. It's just curiosity.
Yeah, I believe it was $65,000.
Okay. All right. Anyway, I would move approval of the contract with the modifications that Art and Cassie have mentioned.
Is there a second?
Yeah, I'll second. I've been seconding Kevin all day long.
Thank you. All right. Any discussion? Art, would you call the vote, please?
Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Jim.
Aye.
Jorge.
Aye.
Elsa.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
Motion passes 6-0.
Okay. The last item on our agenda is a proposed code amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I thought we were done with code amendments because I'm code amendment out. but they're in review of the definition of a spouse. And again, these things come up in the natural course of business. I guess maybe we hadn't seen a domestic partner presented since the last time we've talked about this. One was presented in the last month, and since we're in the season of updating the code to clarify and codify what we're doing, we want to change the code definition of a spouse because the city no longer recognizes domestic partnerships as a benefit plan for purposes of TSRS or health insurance. So this just clarifies that the spouse is we don't acknowledge domestic partnerships. Did I capture that correctly, Cassie?
Yes, you did. And it really impacts our beneficiary designation provisions. So we're just updating to really bring the code in line with current practice.
Do we have any situations where I'm sorry, Elsa, go ahead.
I think you're going where I was going to go, if there's any impact to current based on our rule now.
No, ma'am, because what we're going to do is we will leave any beneficiary designations in place. If someone has designated a domestic partner with, or used consent from a domestic partner, we will honor that. We just won't continue this process going forward.
Okay, thanks. All right, any more discussion? Do I hear a motion to approve the proposed code amendment?
So moved. This is Kevin.
Jim?
Sure, why not? Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? Art, would you call the vote, please?
Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Jim.
Aye.
Jorge.
Aye.
Elsa.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
Motion passes 6-0.
Okay. Do we have anything else we need to discuss today?
Mr. Chairman, the only thing I'll mention is I do not know if we're going to have an April meeting, simply because I do not know if there's agenda items that merit a meeting. I do know that the board needs to approve the budget. I do believe we can do that in May. As of now, that would be the only agenda item that I would have for April. And so I probably will do that for May. But just unless there's something else that comes up, I don't know if Cassie, we need to do anything with that addendum that you referenced in the a GRS item. I don't know if that needs to come before the board or because they already voted on it. We just need to send that to mayor and council. So just FYI, stay alert to your, stay close to your emails. We might end up canceling that meeting if there is not a need to meet, and I'll save you guys some time on the fourth Thursday of May or April.
Thank you.
Okay.
I do have a brief observation. It occurs to me that we put an awful lot of time into cleaning up the disability process, and I think I'm reasonably certain we have not seen a disability application since then. Is there any sense that that is something that is connected, or have we simply been blessed that nobody has been in especially bad physical and mental health of late?
Yeah, I can answer that, Mr. Chairman. I can tell you that the disability applications in general are sort of, they all come at once, and then we'll have a period where we won't say anything for months. Okay. I do know that there is one particular application that is going through the process right now, which actually, come to think of it, if we get the doctor's report back, we will need to meet in April because there is one. I forgot about that, but they're not correlated because we haven't communicated at all. As I've mentioned to the board, we have not taken that to mayor and council as yet because I want to take all of these code changes at once to mayor and council. So I don't have to put four different items on consent agenda and write four different communications for that. But we do have one applicant that is going through the process now. We had to send them to a specialist doctor. And we're waiting for that report to come back. Pete, do you think that'll happen and we'll be ready for April?
I can't tell yet. I have been in communication with the specialist we're trying to get information from, and I would put it at 50-50 right now.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm glad my observation prompted a recollection that we might actually be meeting next month if, in fact, we end up meeting, but it'll be what it'll be. Anything else from anybody? All right. Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So move. This is Alpha.
Is there a second?
I'll second it. This is Jorge.
Thank you. Art, would you call the vote, please?
Yeah. Art.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Jim.
Aye.
Jorge.
Aye.
Elsa.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
We are adjourned at 9:27.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.